You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Tibetan Cultural Exchange, the only podcast that is searching for things that aren't there and ignoring things that are.
I can't believe we become just like everyone else.
Nothing lasts forever. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're talking about Season 3, Episode 7, entitled Chapter 33. This is the one where it has the beautiful sand sculpture, painting, whatever it is.
The sand mandala.
Sand art.
That's what it's called.
The sand mandala?
Mm-hmm.
Is that... Are you making that up?
Nope. I did some research.
It's true?
Yep.
Oh, boy. Okay, cool. That thing is amazing.
It is very cool. And the principal thing of the artwork is it's always ritually destroyed and dumped into running water at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it can take, as it shows, it can take weeks and sometimes months, depending on its size, of coordinated efforts from many monks to do it.
Yeah.
And that, it's
very
beautiful.
Impressive.
It's beautiful. I'm surprised. Mm-hmm. Like... I'm super surprised that they haven't someone hasn't paid enough money to cover it with resin and hang it up on a wall someplace.
They do allow you to take photographs of it, though.
Apparently so. I was kind of surprised. Like I would wonder whether I wonder how the monks feel about that, because the whole thing is a meditation. I guess it's done for meditation and to promote peace and introspection and meditation and harmony.
Yeah. No. It's.
And the destruction is to teach the monks a lesson in humility and in the temperance of life. So I feel like the monks are pretty tight-lipped smiles as people are taking a picture of it, because it's like you're missing the whole fucking point.
Uh-huh. It's one of the few forms of artwork that I've seen that is beautiful both in the finished product and the construction of it.
Sure.
Like I can't think of a procedure that is more just impressive and takes more, I guess in some ways courage and also just patience and dedication.
Sure.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, everything has to be precise and unhurried, but coordinated and combined. And
knowing that all these efforts are going to be destroyed afterward is.
Whew. Yeah. Yeah. It's like,
I was impressed.
I was too. I guess you start, cause I was like, man, where do you start in on that? Because like, what happens if someone just fucks something up? Do you just scribble and start over? Or I guess you can just keep laying shit on top until you get it right. It's kind of like painting in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah.
But are there apprentice ones? Like there's a little 6-inch one you start with and you work up to my first mandala and then you keep going.
You said during the cast or during the episode that it was essentially the coloring book of the Tibetan monks.
It's a spiritual coloring book.
Yep.
Yep. That's exactly what it is.
Good stuff. All right. So who made this episode?
This episode was directed by John Dahl, who blew us away in last week's episode of Justified, The Hunt. I really, really like his direction on that one. And, I want to call out also the scene where Claire says she watched the thing for over an hour.
Uh-huh.
I had a really weird experience with that, where I felt that it was a long time, but I was thinking about a lot of meditative things as I was watching the scene and things about my own life and make these connections. Did you have an experience like that?
A little bit. I
it was kind of transcendent.
It felt like I blinked and the scene was over, but at the same time, I was in my head during that, like you said.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking necessarily about my life and the consequences of my actions and meditating on big things, but yeah.
And then it led to over lunch, we had this big, long conversation about our own mortalities and stuff.
Sure.
I was not prepared for the seriousness of the jelly. And I feel like John Dahl has a lot to, because, the way they shot the angles and we got to Claire's POV as she was kind of looming over it and then got down to eye level, and just the way he filmed the monks, you can see the individual, Netflix can really bang it out when it comes to the high def, and you can see the individual grains of sand locking together, and it just was
beautiful. And I like how it plays out over the course of the entire episode.
Yeah.
It's not just a scene, it's the episode.
And this is such a desaturated palette, mm-hmm. and for the scenes where it's like very properly lit and everything is full sat, it's like seeing color.
Yeah, for the very first time.
When you're normally in black and white. It was written by Bo Willimon.
Okay.
Or Willimon.
Wait, who's he? No.
He is the executive producer, creator of this joint.
His hands are deep in this sand sculpture.
He's all up ins.
That is House of Cards.
A Trippy from St. Louis in the forum said the theme for this episode is don't sneeze. I was dreading because I'm like, oh God, Francis is going to flip this fucking table over with him and Claire being fighting. Like I was waiting for it. I'm like, oh man, are we going to be at war with the bet? Like, how's that even work?
And then they kind of took it the other direction. Like Frank is not angry about this. I feel like this episode in a lot of ways is Frank coming to terms with some stuff about both his life and his presidency and his legacy.
Yeah, seeing FDR's, because that was the other kind of like thing that was happening during the Tibetan painting scene.
Yeah.
As he was visiting the FDR memorial.
Yep.
And I thought that was kind of, you know, I've never even heard of the FDR memorial. And I thought it was actually kind of cool and inspiring just walking through it in a documentary fashion on this show.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. They really hung on the quotes there on the walls.
Yeah, it's like stuff like it's kind of shock. It's somewhat shocking that we are at this time in our nation arguing about a lot of the ideals espoused. Like you would think, I wonder what it was like when the New Deal was proposed. I would like to get like a hardcore history of the history of the New Deal.
That'd be cool.
Like how, because this is like just straight up socialism, communism, where there had never been any before in the midst of a depression and a world war starting and all that. I'm like that. Christ, I can't imagine how you got something like that through Congress.
Yeah.
But
maybe it was very Frank-esque.
And that's probably why it's no one can fix it, because that was like a one-time confluence of events in history. I don't know, but it's probably an amazing story in there somewhere.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because I felt like in the House of Cards universe here, there is a very idealized public and a very idealized media, and even in a lot of ways a very idealized government here, where Frank, just by sheer force of will,
that sounds funny,
can get people to understand his point and say, oh, you're right, instead of bickering and arguing and snapping back and forth at each other. And it's really exemplified in the scene we see from, I don't know what show it is, but it's a couple of political pundits and representatives.
Oh, yeah.
Talking,
Meet the Press.
Talking back and forth about AmWorks and about what it's done. And I don't feel like you would ever get those two sides to agree on the basis that they are two opposing sides.
That's one of the shows I watch on a weekly basis.
Oh, yeah?
And I said this as we watched that this would never happen in real life, because what would they do is instead of having two people that are like sponsors and agree with the bill, they would actually have a pro and against, and they'd both scream at each other and tear down each other's statistics and Chuck Todd would moderate over this din of noise, and no one would learn anything.
Okay.
Like sometimes
that
like
sounds about right.
Like I think what you need to do, and I don't know why they don't do it more often, is like have a whole show dedicated, like some of these big topics, have a whole show dedicated to the pro side and then a show dedicated to the con side, and then maybe you can have a debate show for a part three. But like it's impossible to change anyone's mind or form an opinion when you just have people arguing and screaming.
It is. I don't know. Obviously, I have not been around long enough to see a time when this was not the case, right? In my generation.
I don't think it ever has been. I mean, did you see the movie Lincoln?
Well, okay. Fair enough. But as far as the media goes and news reporting goes,
okay,
you've got the people like Murrow who were actually doing journalism and just giving you the facts, letting you make up your mind, not trying to push an opinion one way or another. This is a lot of editorializing. This is a lot of opinionating and pontificating. From opposing sides.
I think Mauro and Cronkite, one of the things that set their apart is it's not that they didn't editorialize, but they weren't afraid to, I guess, take stands on things.
Really?
Yeah, it's like, it's not, nothing is just the facts, but you know, this false ideal of there's two sides to every story. Well, let's have an anti-vaccinator and a vaccinator on and treat them as if they both have equal merit. It's okay. Crazy. It's sure. Crazy.
I agree with that. Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, there's, you know, a lot, and, you know, a lot of people fucking way over idealize all that shit too. You know, that was in a whole different America.
Yeah, I mean,
that America was not exactly a shining beacon of everything good and wholesome and free either.
Sure, no, absolutely. So, yeah, I feel like maybe if you have that show that does that and says we're going to take a stance and take a side, well, another show is going to take another side, and you're still going to have the situation, but you're not going to have those people talking to each other.
But that's a functional marketplace of ideas. Mm-hmm. What we have now is just fake journalism and false... false compromises and false consensus,
sure,
and echo chambers and all that.
Yeah, yeah. It's all, you know, Illuminati, aliens, all that shit.
Lizard people.
Yeah.
Hollow Earth.
anyway.
I don't know how we got there.
I don't know. Let's talk about journalism. The episode.
What did you think about the framework of this being essentially a flashback to... We open with the renewing of the wedding vows... And then it informs us that it's flashing backward a month. So we it's almost like in the beginning, mommy and daddy were fighting the last episode, but they still love each other very much. And we want you to know that it's going to be okay.
And a little bit of how do they get there from here?
Yeah. I mean, at one point it felt like I robbed it of tension because like when Claire and Frank were at each other's throats later on in the episode, I'm like, well, we know this is going to end up in them wearing ice cream suits and saying pleasant things to each other and Gaffney.
Sure, but it felt to me like the Breaking Bad episode where Walter White goes into Tuco's headquarters.
And blows it up.
We saw the end of that story at the very beginning.
Yeah.
So you're thinking, how does that even get there?
So there's another, that's a good one. There's another pair. One that we go to a lot is the 13 miles out or 11 miles out episode of The Walking Dead, where they open with Rick and Shane fighting in the schoolyard and zombies breaking out. Yeah. And we're like, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I think that... The more compelling the situation you see the end state at, the more... So this is kind of like between those two.
And the more disparity between
the
end state and the beginning state.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of between those two extremes. So
I did too, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm like, so my default state is kind of pointless and robbed tension.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go that far, but
it's not
I see why you say
like
that.
I'm not pounding the table like Khrushchev style. I'm just kind of like, not sure we needed that.
Sure, all right. What do you think of Claire with brown hair? Because she's right up front here. We see her with brown hair, which is probably the most shocking thing about that scene.
Not a huge fan. I think think Robin Wright looks the best and is most impressive as kind of an ice queen. And there's a lot of tricks they do. Something that's kind of interesting about the way she does her hair.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not just a straight pixie bob or anything. Like it's kind of like asymmetrical. And it's not quite the can I talk to your manager like bitch style haircut that's like stereotypical.
I can't picture that haircut, but okay.
You can't? Uh-huh. You don't know the let me talk to your manager haircut? Google it. It's a meme.
Let me talk to your manager haircut?
Yeah, can I see your manager? Can I speak to your... It's the can I speak to your manager haircut.
Okay.
It's a variation of that. And also, I feel like that the Ice Queen blonde hair, but with the root showing... adds a level of kind of like the stupid fucking Las Vegas commercials that are like the right amount of naughty.
Uh-huh.
That's Claire. She's like hits all the buttons.
Okay.
With brown hair, she's just I don't know, some not as impressive.
Yeah, she doesn't.
She's not as scary. She's a little warmer,
certainly,
and approachable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which maybe that's what they were going for.
That's kind of what I don't want in my Claire, right?
Yeah.
Especially as a UN ambassador, I kind of want her to be seen as an intimidating.
It's like imagine
person.
Walter White. Uh-huh. He starts off bald with a goatee, and then he gets cancer, and he grows out the stupid mustache and the hair. It's like that's what. What? That's not what I want to
direction.
See.
Yeah.
We're heading backwards, man. Come on, Claire. You've turned into Teddy Bear.
Sure. Sure. But I mean, that maybe that's going along with Frank's. What I see as a regression in Frank's intimidation factor as well.
Yeah, he's wearing a Colonel Sanders outfit, Boss Hog outfit.
Getting very introspective and very, I don't know, it's a different side of Frank that I'm not used to, you know, especially when the writer is talking to him, Thomas, and is bringing things out of him that we don't even get a huge glimpse into, you know?
Yeah. So what is the right thing to say here? Is it true that what Frank said in a moment of despair as he's playing the Stanley Parable, apparently unwinnable game that I, like many others, own on Steam and have never played? Yeah. He says that this fight, the scabs keep coming off and you can't take back some things.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Or is the renewing vows, Underwood's Reforged United correct?
Nothing lasts forever.
So you don't think there's going to be any nagging injuries left from this battle?
There might be, but again, nothing lasts forever, and I think those will go away. I took it more. I mean, obviously, Claire took it as a very positive thing too, right? This nothing lasts forever. She at the end of the episode crawls into bed with him, and they both seem like they are willing to at least try to move past this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, he took the step with the whole, you know, like you said, nothing lasts forever, which we had no idea, but that's like, I think, an homage to the classic House of Cards. Because when we got finished watching this episode, it recommended the classic House of Cards, and you're like, is that any good? And I'm like, I said, it might be amazing, but I couldn't make it through three episodes. And he's like, why not? And I'm like, you know what? Play 5 minutes of it. You will see that even explaining. So we were watching it, and I was trying to get him the idea that this is just so dated.
Yeah.
Every sense of the word, the image quality, the costuming, the sets, the fashion, the teeth, everything was 80s Britain.
Yeah. And yeah, it's also British.
So. But he did in one of his fourth wall breaking monologue.
It's almost right at the very beginning of
the
show.
Right at the very, like in the first minute, he says, he kind of shrugs and is like, nothing lasts forever. And we're like, oh my God, I think we just saw an homage there.
Yeah. So, I mean, if that gives you any indication as to how this series is going to end, I don't think Frank's presidency is going to last forever.
Sure. And then she jumped into bed with him and jetpacked him.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so I don't know.
I felt like part of that nothing lasts forever is him going to the FDR memorial and seeing, you know, Eleanor and Franklin separate.
He takes it all in and says, I'm going to piss on this grave.
Well, when he said pay
my respects.
Yeah. Meacham, keep everybody back 100 yards.
Actually, Meacham, can you crawl up on FDR's lap while I take my pants off? I feel another three-way coming on.
Oh, God.
Then we'll walk down the monument and see about Eleanor.
I think I've lost my train of thought. but he sees that, right? And he goes, you know what? It prompts him to reconnect with his wife. He sees that, like, this person built this really nice, he has like a really nice memorial to himself. He obviously has a legacy that he's left the country with, but at the same time, his wife was alienated, and it doesn't seem like Frank wants to do that. It seems like Frank wants in that moment to reconnect with his wife because he knows that this is not going to last forever. And then he wants to spend some quality time, much like the judge with the Alzheimer's.
No, he
wants
to
spend some time with his family.
He realized like he's missed a month of life with his partner.
Yeah.
And they're a good team. And how much other things, how long is he going to let this play out and still keep missing these things? Because I went back. I mean, I feel like when they were having that conversation and he's talking about, I can't believe we become like everyone else. And they were like picking on each other's fights. I started to come down on or get pissed at Frank because I guess at the end of the day, I'm a Claire fan. I like Claire better than I like Frank.
Might be right.
And it's who started it? It's hard to say because she took like a principled stand. But on the other hand, we talked about how that is such a dereliction of the various duties that she signed up with, both real express job description things and also just societal expectations
and her agreement with Frank. You know, she has an unspoken agreement to always support him as well as he support her.
Yeah. But then Frank, you know, going to, I wish I'd never made you ambassador. And then, you know, I guess it's like also this was the episode of him coming to terms with her actual contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thing that turned me against him is when they're having that fight in the private quarters or whatever, and there's that really awesome scene of them coming off the plane and just going in their separate ways and the doors bang shut at the same time.
Yep.
But they're having that fight, and he was like, the thing that seemed like pissed him off the most was the fact that she had the gall to suggest that she made him president.
Yes.
When to me, that's a factual statement.
Mm-hmm.
They worked seamlessly together to push each other to ever higher heights, up to the top office of the United States.
Yep.
It did. It seemed like inarguable, and that was like the most unfair thing. And so it's like, I feel like he needed to come correct on that, and I guess he did with the painting picture.
Yeah, I mean, at some point he realized that, you know, it was not just himself getting him to where he is. LeClaire was a huge part of that. So they make up. They make up. What else is there to talk about with
lots of stuff
with Frank and Claire?
Presidential portrait.
okay.
If I'm getting my presidential portrait, I want to be on like a white horse that's rearing up, and I want my hand in the air holding a saber.
You want to be on the front of a fantasy novel, not a presidential portrait.
And maybe my shirt's half ripped off, and I want like
it's Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah,
what you want.
Yeah, essentially, and like, you know, the first lady is riding Pillion in the back.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of legs showing.
Yep.
Why doesn't anyone ever do that? Because you're the president who says no.
Because you're the president of the United States. Because that reflects poorly on your entire country.
100 years from now, when you're dead and forgotten and no one remembers your name, they're walking through the Smithsonian or taking the White House tour, and there's all these presidents standing in front of mantles, and mm-hmm. then you have the glorious, especially if you're a peacetime president, and you just go for the war hero portrait.
People remember,
they're like, who the hell is that? I'm Wikipedia-ing him,
mm-hmm.
or whatever the Wikipedia of the 2100s are.
On a horse with a maiden, I love it.
Yeah, especially since everything was so staid, and then boom, this hits you.
Yeah, I feel like when you have the fates of 300 plus million people in your hand, maybe that's not a great idea for you to do that. Although I would have one commissioned in secret. I would have artists come in and do some ridiculous paintings of me, and you know, they unearth those 200 years later. Who really cares at that point?
That's true.
But oh my God, if we found a picture of George Washington like exactly in that pose, it would be amazing.
Can we talk about Thomas?
Yeah.
Who is playing whom in this role? I mean, it seems like that Frank is very clearly trying to dictate specific passages in the book,
mm-hmm.
and then being kind of coy about, oh, you can't. He says a fairly innocuous anecdote, and oh, that doesn't make it into the memo. And at one point, Thomas gets frustrated. Look, like, when are you going to stop bullshitting me and telling me the truth? And he drops he's like, hey, my whole first book was a lie. And that definitely gave Frank pause. But then, you know, like Frank's like, you have no idea my secrets, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, you stole half a dead gay man's book. Well, I murdered a congressman and shoved a reporter in front of a train. And I'm trying to track down this runaway whore right now, but she's wily and she's giving me quite the chase. Like, there's secrets and then there's secrets. So where is this going?
Well, I mean, it's very apparent that, you know, Thomas is trying to find the book that makes sense to write about this guy. And he knows he's being bullshitted. Frank knows he's bullshitting the guy. He's trying everything in his power to get Frank to open up. And whether that be whiskey or anecdotes about his friend dying, he's going to use everything he can to get it. I don't know exactly where I see this going. I feel like with Frank sort of realizing a lot of things about himself here, he might open up a little bit and want to tell a different story, want to tell the true story of Frank Underwood.
Yeah.
Through this book. And this might be just the guy who can get him to open up and do that. I don't know exactly where it's going. I don't really see the overall point of having a book written about him yet. But we still have six episodes.
It's supposed to sell Amworks, which in this episode, I feel like he's winning the PR battle. Because, yes, you know, it's status quo. It's like, hey, if they ever get the shit together in Congress, I'm going to veto it. If they override me, then I forget what is, then I'll win in the Supreme Court.
This book is going to take forever to write, though. There's no way this book comes out before his next presidential election.
But that was the condition.
I know, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Oh, I don't. Yeah,
books take a long time. Getting a true story takes a long time.
Nah, I think, yeah, I'd be surprised if it just goes away. Like, it's going to come out, and I think it's going to be a bombshell, probably against Frank.
You're probably right. That's not very realistic, though.
Oh, yeah, I'll buy that.
Okay.
Let's see, what else do we have to talk about? Is he going to have
to murder a writer this season?
I was wondering about
that. Is that what's going to happen?
Because, man, Frank's going to be pissed.
You made me look like a box of assholes. Time to die.
Can we talk about Kate and Tom? And it looks like that Kate is wanting to jump his book writing bones.
Mm-hmm. And he's playing right back at her.
Mm, he's playing hard to get, I would say.
He is, but she knows that he wants it. He knows that he wants it.
Does he want it?
He knows that she wants it. Yeah, everybody's in on this game here.
But
that
Kate,
they're playing.
Kate is the sworn enemy of the Underwood presidency at this point.
Yeah.
Because she wants revenge for Aaliyah or whatever the hell her name was.
Ayla.
Tom is an ally of Underwood's, at least now. So, like, clearly this is going to set up something where there's going to be some kind of conflict.
I don't think Tom is an ally. I don't think Tom is an ally. I think Tom's there as a free agent.
Yeah, he's a mercenary.
Yeah. And
so
he's doing what
Kate
he's going to do.
Co-ops him?
She's trying to, obviously.
Is what Tom's seeing in his presidency something he's liking or something he's not liking? Because I feel like he's starting to see things that he likes about this presidency. He likes the First Lady a lot. Now that he sees, like, this is a very, you know, when you see moments like a Frank like this, it humanizes him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know the truly monstrous things about him yet. And I guess that's what I don't know, because
how, like, far is he going to dig?
Kate's going after him just on policy and stuff, but she has no idea the kind of radioactive waste that he's built his presidency on.
Yeah.
Either one of these two journalists get a hold of this, and, like, is the Hammer going to get back involved? Are we going to see Hammer and Janine get back involved? Like, it's going to be the fearsome foursome?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It depends on whether or not Frank can strategically give Thomas enough book without revealing the truly disturbing stuff about Frank. And it feels like that's what he's trying to do. And these moments of, you know, oh, I'm drunk and I'm revealing these things, those are the moments where I don't think he's going to say anything that would incriminate him as far as, like, a crime, but he is willing to show a different side of Frank. And that's the thing that's attracting Thomas.
Sure.
And kind of getting him to say, okay, I like this guy a little more.
What do you think about Michael Corrigan, the gay rights activist widower, sending Claire this flower package?
Seems right on.
But,
you know, like,
what was the point? Because, right,
I thought it was to say thank you for standing up for him.
I get obviously. That, but I'm talking narratively. The point of focus was on Claire's battle to make sure Francis didn't look like an asshole on the Jordan Valley thing.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the fact that she knew, were we supposed to get that, like, this was a reminder of the cost that Frank paid for her principles, and now that, like, renewed the fire to make sure she held these people accountable to their word so that he wouldn't look like an asshole in the Jordan Valley thing? She couldn't let the Russians win on this?
Could be, yeah. I don't really have any other good guesses, so.
How did she know he knows she liked tulips? I'm like, fucking tulips for real? It'd be one thing if you liked your favorite flower is snapdragons or asparagus or some shit like that. Asparagus. But, like, tulips is in the top three, right? You got roses, tulips, and orchids.
She says that every time she orders a steak and it comes with asparagus, she's like, how did you know? Asparagus is my favorite flower.
I'm like, come on. Like, and plus it's a morning. That's like a classic morning flower.
Okay. You sure, a tulip is not an uncommon flower for people to like.
I just thought that was interesting, and I wonder if that's going anywhere.
I don't know.
I'm trying to think what else. We got Doug to talk about. There's a lot of Doug shit going on here.
What about the flinchiness in Claire? I really like how they have her mention to Frank, you know, you're looking for things that aren't there.
But that was actually
there. It was actually there, and then she realizes that later on when she's talking to the person, I think, who's from Israel, I don't know what her position is, but they're working with Africa, right, to kind of subvert this thing that's going through the UN.
Uh-huh.
And she says basically the exact same thing to her, uses the same line on her.
Yeah.
Looking for things that aren't there, seeing things that aren't there. And Claire realizes, no, that's not the case. And that's certainly not the case here. And I guess you're right. It wasn't the case with Frank either, but
no,
I
saw her fucking flinch. So
yeah. But her realization, I thought, at near the end was very good.
And I thought that was because if they didn't put that in there, then Frank just looks like a total asshole. That was kind of like the way for them to be like, you guys are both inventing things and doing things on purpose to deny.
Sure, you know. And that's a big part of why she comes home and then goes right into bed with Frank.
Which, that's what I hate about any kind of relationship, friends, lovers, whatever. It's like, if you're upset, would you please fucking own the fact you're upset rather than be like, I'm not upset, mm-hmm, and I'm going to continue acting like a dick.
just passive-aggressive bullshit.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, and it's like, that's what I'm saying. Like, I was kind of disappointed to see them becoming like everyone else. Now we talk about Doug, right?
Yeah.
Gavin is high if he thinks Doug is going to unfreeze his passport before he delivers Rachel.
But he's got a picture of a Jewish woman in a bread line during the Great Depression.
During the Russian, just some mamushka. No, seriously, she looks like a Russian grandmother.
She does.
She's about to break out in Matchmaker. It was crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what's with the shawl. I don't know what's with her face, but she has aged 25 years over the last season.
I mean, they say the presidency ages you.
It's a New Mexican sun.
They say the presidency ages you, which I always thought that's interesting. It's like, look at a picture of Bush. Now look at a picture of Bush 8 years older. Well, look at a picture of Aaron. Look at a picture of Aaron 10 years from now. It's a horror show. It's always a horror show. Like, I wish I could go back and punch my 20-year-old self. I'm like, dude, take off your shirt more. Get a tighter bathing. You are never going – you actually look pretty good. You're never going to look better. And same way now. It's like, as bad as you think you look, you're going to look like shit in 10 years. Like, people get old. The decade does a lot of aging.
Yes.
But if the presidential office ages you in dog years, it seems like being hunted by the office of the president ages you in, like – gerbil years.
Oh yeah,
she's looking,
she's fruit fly territory here.
3 weeks she's dead. But no, Doug's like, nice try, asshole, I need an exact location.
Yeah,
which makes sense. Like, you know, Doug's like, oh well, I got an approximation of your passport unfrozen.
How about this? Now Doug Stamper is hooked into some kind of CCTV feed while he's talking to Dunbar on the phone.
This might be good.
I don't know how he got this feed. I don't know where this feed necessarily is from. It's apparently from New Mexico or something, because he is watching and he thinks he sees Rachel crossing the street.
Wait, I thought this was just, these were just the various appearances that he was able to get. Like, I didn't think this was live. I thought this was...
Oh, was there like a disc or something? He's got
that was a part of the things that we saw him uncover last episode.
Okay. All right, so he's watching this video clip.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks he sees Rachel. I saw Zoe in this scene.
You absolutely did.
I think that is Zoe crossing the street.
When you first said, I'm like, oh, fuck you. But then now, I'm like, oh, there were like the aural hallucinations. So yeah, let's rewind and watch. I'm convinced it's Zoe.
Yeah. So we know that it's not obvious. It's not actually Zoe. Zoe's dead. She got pushed in front of a subway train.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, him hallucinating and seeing Zoe here, maybe he is haunted by the things that he has done at this point,
and help do, and things he knows, and also that he knows if he pursues this to his logical end, it is going to end, have the exact same outcome.
Yeah.
And he's clearly bothered by that, because he had something weird and disturbing with Rachel.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it wasn't whiskey sprayed in the mouth, bourbon sprayed in the mouth weird, but it was still read to me like my mom used to.
Uh-huh.
Why I weep and masturbate in a corner weird.
Yeah, Stamper's a weird guy. No bourbon syringes this episode either.
Plus, he paid her to give him a blowjob. And mm-hmm. They're like, there's a lot of gross background between him and Rachel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I don't know where else to go from here, but...
I feel like there's one other thing.
Oh, what about his physical therapist?
Yes, that's the one I was going to go to. The party. Boss, I like to call her.
The boss?
We are both on high alert. We are on red alert about her being a spy.
For Dunbar, yeah.
And there's also the, I think, another possibility, which is because I feel like there's a little bit enough of him being skeptical and being skeptical of her in general and the way he was performing to suggest that something else they might be going for is he's going to suspect she's a spy. Because if he's still doing this Rachel thing, like, he's still working for Frank. Like, I feel like he's got to be working for Frank, because why would he be trying to track her down and or kill her unless maybe he's trying to protect her?
No. If he wants to track down Rachel as evidence to use against Frank.
Oh.
Turn Frank in, say, here's the shit, and here's the person who the shit happened to.
But the other thing is, like, if she genuinely loves him on a human level, mm-hmm. and his paranoia and job destroys that, and he accuses her and becomes a crazy person, then that would also be kind of a very Dougie type storyline too.
It would.
And kind of fitting, like a poetic justice kind of way.
Yeah, that's still way up in the air for me.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't totally. Know where that ball is going to fall, but at some point, I feel like it has to.
Sure.
I mean, with at least letting us know where his true allegiances lie, I don't think we've been told that firmly enough yet.
I buy that.
Okay.
I'm trying to think. That's about it. I mean, it's so they're adults of a certain age. They're in their late 30s, early 40s. I feel like it's weird when I see if she's going to stick around and not go to Seattle. Because mm-hmm. I'm thinking, like, if I was in a situation where as a mature adult, I decided that I'm going to, for whatever reason, for job, for career, for personal reasons, I'm going to go across the country.
Yep.
And I have a client that I hand off to someone else, immediately invite to a party, and then bone. That doesn't change my plans, right? I go to Seattle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's something, if you were a college student.
She didn't know about the rain. That changes her plans.
Yeah.
No, you're right, though. Yeah, I don't think she is going. It, assuming she is not lying about her intentions or whatever. That gives me an idea. What if.
One thing I thought is, like, but Albuquerque's not close enough to Seattle to.
No.
Because I'm like, well, you know, if she was lost in Oregon, on the Oregon Trail, then, you know, he could work that into a visit. But Albuquerque is not particularly close to Seattle. Seattle's not particularly close to anything.
No, I was wondering if maybe she is a spy. She's lying about going to Seattle, and she's going to be spotted somewhere around D.C. still by him. But I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, if she's going to spy on him, she'd be, like, in a couple situation.
Yeah, that would be ideal.
I don't know. I got my like eye. Frank and Martha, I got my eye on the boss.
Yeah,
I'm deeply skeptical of the boss and her motivations.
Can we talk a little bit about how the plot was advanced in this episode?
Sure.
Because we didn't talk about, like, Africa and Israel and how they were. Israel was putting some pressure on Africa to come in and say, "Hey, we want control of the troops." You're right. It all gets unraveled at the end. Yeah.
And also, just like, it feels like the idea that anyone would seriously suggest that Zimbabwe is put under, you know, the supreme allied commander, like, mm-hmm. that's kind of ridiculous, in the same way that someone suggesting Greece or I don't know the Guam, like, there's no command and support structure, there's no infrastructure. It's just I feel like I wish they'd come up with a less ridiculous suggestion for that.
Well, I mean, that was, yeah, I don't know. It was kind of the point, but I'm trying
to. I guess it's a poison pill, and maybe they just want a shorthand for poison pill.
I mean, that is the thing, right? Like, they don't want this to pass, and so adding this amendment to it, on the face of it, say, no, that's not happening. Forget that.
Yeah, like, what nation state would you put there that would be believable and yet still ridiculous? Like,
but they didn't want something believable, right?
Yeah, I guess.
They wanted something in your face.
It made Israel seem very heavy-handed.
Yeah.
Or, like, not very subtle. And maybe that's what they wanted.
Which is fine. It makes, you know, for the people who maybe wouldn't understand if, like, a Greece were mentioned there or something, mm-hmm. myself included.
I wouldn't either. Like, I'm trying to think, like, Iceland?
Like people who wouldn't get the point that this is clearly just there to sabotage that bill.
I feel like you need a NATO power would probably, you know, one of the lesser NATO powers would still raise eyebrows, but, you know, I don't know.
But they don't want to raise eyebrows. They just want to kill the thing.
Yeah, true. True.
So I feel like it was good. It was fair enough shorthand for the audience. So cultural exchange is happening, which implies that the Tibetan monks are here in the White House doing their thing. Therefore, somebody is over in Tibet from the U.S. doing their thing. Who do you think it is, and what do you think they're doing
the
over there?
The cast of the Jersey Shore. And they are fist bump, chapstick, uh-huh. and GTLing it.
Okay, I like it.
And that will be the death of the sand mandalas. That culture will infect and destroy uh-huh. the beautiful, spiritual, moving culture.
3 years from now, it's just Tibetan monks in tank tops, and grease back hair.
Acid wash jeans.
Uh-huh. And they've built a boardwalk across the top of the mountain.
There you go.
Perfect.
Solved it. They're all selling hot pink t-shirts with rude sayings on them.
Oh, God. All right. That's it for the episode, right?
Yeah, we got feedback.
Let's do it.
We have feedback, son. Liz G said on the podcast for Chapter 31, you mentioned the character of Frank's secretary not seeing her, and here's the reason why. She directed me to a People.com article that says Elizabeth Norman, the seasoned TV actress who most recently starred as an unflappable Beltway secretary on season 2 of The House of Cards, has died at the age of 61. Bo Willimon released a statement saying, everyone here at the House of Cards production is deeply saddened by Elizabeth's passing. She was a talented actress and a warm soul and a good friend to us all. She has had a long career that spanned both stage and screen. She hailed from the Yale School of Drama, was a founding member of the American Repertory Theater. She also appeared on a slew of TV shows, including L.A. Law, ER, Party of Five, and had a recurring role as a judge on Law and Order from 2002 to 2008. I was kind of surprised that they didn't address that in the story. And also, I kind of thought maybe there would be a dedication. And if we saw one, I didn't. I feel like if there was one, I would have researched it and found this out. But I'm kind of surprised they didn't make note of this.
Did it happen between seasons? Or
it did. Okay. I think she died in October of last year. But okay. Still, there's nothing, literally nothing, that would prevent them from season one black screen before or after the show saying, you know, in memorial of.
Sure.
But so that explains it. Now I'm bummed out.
All right. Nothing lasts forever.
Nothing lasts forever. It's, maybe we should do more Tibetan sand paintings, sand mandalas.
That's what we're doing for lunch with Jim and Aaron next week. We should totally try that.
For the next, like, 11 weeks.
No, we'll get the starter kit. We'll get the six by six.
Yeah. All right. And we'll do it as fast as, and we'll make it a competition. We'll completely destroy every piece of the cultural exchange. I think we should actually do that.
Yes.
I feel like an asshole because it's a beautiful thing, man.
Sure.
Like, I feel like I'm throwing acid in a supermodel's face or something.
Do you feel like that when, like, if you were to start painting or something?
No, because I'm not misappropriating a cultural phenomenon with deep religious and philosophical significance and then perverting it.
Why are you perverting it if you're...
To make it into a competition and exploiting it for commercial purpose.
Well,
and
we don't have to compete. We can just do it.
We will.
Oh, boy.
Because I can Mandel the hell out of you. I can Mandela circles around you, buddy.
Yeah, but
literally,
you could.
Circles, interlocking circles with complex geometric patterns.
Multiple layers and...
three-dimensional height and depth. Yeah.
That was a really impressive thing, the 3D aspect of that.
I can't get enough.
Amazing.
Mr. Rock and Rock says, no... Whoa. I almost said no welly. Whoa, Nelly, this is a doozy that got me really worked up. I seem to share the overall taste with y'all. These clearly diverge when it comes to specifics. An episode or scene I enjoy, you'll not appreciate, and one that you love, I'll sometimes hate. It's the way of the world, man.
Yep.
I'm really curious to see how you come away from this one. As for me, I'll tell you how I really feel. Here are the issues I had with this. Undercover McFoyle. I had no issues with how the scenes unfolded. I think he's talking about...
Gavin,
yeah. Yep. And what was Gavin's name, last name?
Orsay.
I can't believe you got that. On the surface,
I don't know why.
On the surface, I liked what Max planned and how he played it, But I thought about it, the more I found some things to question. I understand why the writers have to do this, but the extent of Mac's acting chops are hella unrealistic. He's not just making up a story and telling it with a straight face. He's going deep, deep undercover and trying to finesse a tangentially relevant info from a lesbian Christian. To do so, he's projecting suppressed psychological issues, obvious enough for his mark to recognize, but subtle enough for her not to question. Mm-hmm. He's also pulling off some serious anguish despondency while crying on command about testing HIV positive. Again, I realize why it's necessary for the story, but in real life, what he did is incredibly difficult for average Joes and even trained actors to execute. I'd agree.
He's a social engineering expert. What can you say? But I broadly agree. It didn't hit me how difficult that must be for him and what kind of toll it was taking on him until he said it this episode.
Yeah, and that's
like pretending you have AIDS is a terrible, horrible thing to do to somebody to get information out of them. It didn't register that was such a horrific thing.
Yeah, really. And also I feel like that they got a little twisted up with the – I mean, clearly I think this is one of those shows where they kind of make things up as they go along. Mm-hmm. Because it is a very – I'm not saying they don't exist, but a slightly fundamental, extremely evangelical Christian sect that has like a Sunday school teacher lesbian, that's not a big – That's not a huge market segment, right?
No, not at all.
And I feel like that they didn't have all that fleshed out before. They're like, "Oh, let's make them lovers." So now you've got this still weird backstory, and now she's also a sexual disease advocate, and she's all
an
about
advocate for sexual.
No, I'm
diseases.
Just saying she's not an advocate, but she's all about getting tested and wearing condoms and stuff. It's like, good Lord, yes. You're like the 1%.
Yeah, she's into some things most people aren't into.
Interesting combinations. Like straight edgers. I don't get straight edgers either.
All right.
Like you got the punk lifestyle, but you don't do sex, drugs, or rock and roll. Well, I guess they do the rock and roll.
They do. Yeah, they do
the
rock and roll.
Sex and drugs they stay away from.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just don't get it. My Dinner with Corrigan. The profound back and forth between Claire and Corrigan was where I felt betrayed by House of Cards bait and switch. This was not the show seasons 1 and 2 geared me up for. This is basically a stage play performed by a hipster doofus, and the collective gravitas of Robin Wright and the man who played Corrigan was unable to sell it. Yes, Breaking Bad gave us The Fly, but that felt authentic and rang true to the characters. Oh, and it was architected by Team Villigan. This attempt to wax philosophic about gay rights, principles, marriage, fairness, etc. was so basic. The points and counterpoints weren't deep or compelling and were barely worthy of points on a high school debate. I do not agree.
I don't either, but...
Like, this individual scene, but the whole episode as a whole, I thought, got me thinking a lot of things deeply in geopolitical terms. Mm-hmm. I also hated how artificially smart they were supposed to be. Claire's bluffing her way to the removal of the bug. Corrigan smugly assuming she's read his FBI jacket. Both one-upping each other at every turn by telling the other how they truly feel despite what they just said. For me, it was not charming, smart, or a deep conversation about the complexity of world issues or a battle royale between intellectual giants who'd finally met their matches.
So he hated last episode.
He hated a lot of parts of it. Continuing with the real Petrov. So Petrov is secretly a social liberal and his homophobia is simply political calculus. What an interesting reveal. Here's another out-of-character character revelation, and for what? Was it to soften Petrov? If so, it didn't feel real. If anything, it felt like a weak device to educate the audience about the complexity of gay rights legislation behind the scenes. I didn't buy it. Perhaps I've been spoiled by the way Sorkin did things. He handled the subject more deftly with Jed Bartlett at that Hollywood fundraiser.
He's talking about West Wing?
Yeah, I guess so.
I haven't seen it.
I don't know, man. I liked it. I think it's... I don't know what Putin is like in real life. But I guess I've always assumed a certain cynicism. Like, there's no way someone is this powerful and rich with this many connections and doesn't have some gay people that they know and respect. Maybe I'm being naive, but it feels like that anytime you kick around these conservative quarters, they all have some skeletons in their closet that, they've made personal exceptions for. This is just taking one leap forward, and this guy's actually got, makes the further connection. It's like, it's not just my cousin who's a gay person is okay. All gay people are okay. I just am forced by this system I'm in to act like they're not.
Okay.
So I don't have a problem with it.
Fine from that angle. I think it's also, anytime you see a mainstream show doing something like this, you're going to necessarily get a slightly watered down version of it.
Sure.
Even the stuff that you want to stand up and applaud is going to be slightly watered down from the real conversations that are going on in the real space that is daily concerned about this stuff.
Sure.
So, I mean, I don't know what his background is with this, but if that's in fact like what he's doing a lot and having these discussions and talking with people who are closer to the issue, yeah, you're not going to get those a super nuanced view on mainstream television.
That's a good point as well. His final point on Claire's meltdown, he goes, The Rock said, "Let's talk about Suicide Revelation. In a way, I envy the viewer who can watch that and gasp. I honestly do. I simply found myself questioning logistics. How on earth did Claire sleep through that? Ding. Fine, it's a more powerful reveal than something that like that that happens almost literally under your nose, but come on. And don't get me started on that scene she made at the presser. This is not the Claire Underwood that we were sold in the previous seasons. Ding, I agree with that. The Corrigan's words and death moved her. That moved her was that Corrigan's words and death moved her. So was a betrayal of her character. She was not that brittle, and his words were not that profound. That she lost it at the Kremlin on live television in front of the Russian president was so much at stake was another betrayal. I broadly agree. When it comes to such stakes, she's as pragmatic and calculating as they come. But the final betrayal was her justification of her actions to Frank. Her argument was not a Claire Underwoodian argument. This crisis of conscience was not even close to earn, and her predictable retort of, I should have never made you president, did not salvage it. I did like Frank's fourth wall break here, but even that was not enough. They're obviously taking her character to another place, but they're sabotaging her character en route. En route. Unless...
I don't totally agree here.
I don't either. Unless I'm mistaken, if you take a peek out of the Air Force One window, I think you might make out a faint image of a shark that is flying over.
Nah. I think your characterization of Claire is not correct, frankly. Season one, Claire is a very caring person, and her charities were not just a cover to help Frank out or anything. She was genuinely doing things that she thought was important, and that it happened to help Frank was a benefit. But I don't know that she had her own mission there too.
I don't even know that I agree with you that far, but I will say that Claire has always been the one that feels things profoundly and then goes against her humanity. Where Frank is able to, it's not that he doesn't have any fellow feeling for anyone, but once you get on his shit list, you become an unperson and he can do unspeakable things.
And pretty much everyone is on his shit list.
And then just not really be that traumatized by it.
Mm-hmm.
But Claire always, I feel like Claire is the one that feels the weight of her actions. So this was just a bridge too far for her.
Yeah, you're right.
But thanks for the email. It's always good to get other people's experiences.
Sure, and I'm not saying my opinion is right on that.
Hell no.
I'm just saying that's my opinion. So,
Brett from Brooklyn. With Rachel disappearing in New Mexico, perhaps she's seeing a vacuum repair man about a dust filter for a Hoover. I had a question about the whole Gavin plot. Namely, where does that he find time to do any of this stuff? It's been already established that he has to sneak around and take multiple taxis just to meet Stamper, and that he's under tight security at work, a minor slip up away from federal prison. But he seems to be able to carry on his hanging out relationship / intricate in-person scam with Lisa. He just seems to have a lot of leeway for someone with very little leeway.
I think the thing that is not super apparent here is the amount of time that passes between each episode.
Well,
which affords him a lot of opportunity to do these things. Because, I mean, between each episode, there are weeks and weeks, sometimes months.
Yeah, that's true. Like, this was a month.
Yeah. So in a month, could Gavin get away with doing a little snooping and having one clandestine meeting? I think so. Over the course of an entire month.
Yeah, I don't know. If anything, I'm thinking that they didn't show a lot of things that he was doing with Lisa. And I felt like this is legitimate. It's something to raise my eyebrows in retrospect, but I didn't get it in the moment. I mean, that's something we talk about a lot on The Walking Dead. Once if a show hasn't broken your suspension of disbelief, then the little things that have kind of slightly tripped it up are not apparent.
Yeah.
As soon as it does break your suspension of the belief, suddenly the whole thing's laid bare and you can see the artifice of it all. And it's like, And that's why you get people that
jump
get
the shark moment.
That's yeah. where people get outraged if they still are in the suspension of disbelief. It's like, oh, you're just fucking nitpicking. Whereas the nitpickers are saying, look at all these things why our suspension was broken.
Yeah.
So
I get it.
Yeah. Thomas W. Sent in an email that said, I like your comments about Air Force One having a picture window for the president. The Obama administration is ordering the next plane to replace the current one that Reagan ordered. There are actually two planes in the fleet, and the Air Force has set aside $1.65 billion for two 747-8s.
Jesus!
For that kind of crash, the cash they should have...
Ooh, $800 million each?
For that kind of cash, they should have picture windows and disco balls.
Yeah, they should.
I imagine that the president's 747 has some pretty sophisticated shit in it.
Except for picture windows.
Well, we'll see. I did some little research on this. The 747 is obviously the largest American-made airplane, and it's the longest in history. I believe the Airbus 380 is a little bit wider from a wingspan perspective. It's a third generation of the venerable 747 with lengthened fuselage, redesigned wings, and improved efficiency. It's the largest version of the 747, the largest commercial aircraft built in the U.S., longest passenger aircraft in the world. In 2007, the United States Air Force was seeking to upgrade the Air Force One by replacing the Boeing BC-25s, which are two heavily modified 747-200B classes. In 2009, Boeing was reported to be exploring a 747-8 proposal, along with a 787 Dreamliner variant. On January 28, 2015, this is breaking news, folks. The Air Force announced a selection of the 747-8 to replace the aging VIC-25s for presidential transport. Air Force Secretary wow. Deborah Lee James said, "This is the only aircraft manufactured in the United States that, when fully missionized, meets the necessary capabilities established to execute the presidential support mission."
Meaning that it has expanded bathrooms and a movie theater.
Well, here's the thing. This thing, its cruising speed is Mach 0.85.
Oh, God.
85% of the speed of sound. Its maximum speed
Like 600 miles an hour?
That is 570 miles an hour.
570?
Okay. Depending on your altitude and all that, but whatever. Yep. Its maximum speed is 0.9 Mach, almost the speed of sound. It can go 8,000 nautical miles, which is 8,000 nautical miles or 9,200 actual miles without refueling. And has a payload of like 300,000 pounds. So it can hold a lot of gear, a lot of dudes, a lot of weapons and countermeasures, and it's fucking fast.
All of it boils down to lots of gear, lots of dudes, fucking fast.
And Meachums.
Frankly, when you're reading models, I'm just hearing wah-wah, wah-wah, or that sort of thing.
See, I'm a huge fan of aviation, so I thought that was interesting.
Okay, cool.
So, fuck off. Liz G says, have you heard if there's going to be a fourth season of House of Cards? I've heard rumors, but I've intentionally stayed away because I feel like if I hear that there's a season four, that I will know kind of how the season's going to go. Like, if there's a season four, then Frank's not dying and or disgraced.
And he's probably going to win the presidency again and all that kind
of
stuff.
So I only got another like a week of this stuff to before I can start kind of spoiling myself on next season, if there is one. But no, I have no idea.
So one thing that probably doesn't tell us much, but if you go to IMDb and you look at House of Cards, you can see that there is a episode one scheduled for season four on there. But that's,
what did I just say?
But that
I just
that is not necessarily ironclad, right? Like IMDb has been wrong and is wrong often. So take that with a grain of salt.
Never should have made you co-host.
Take that with a grain of Tibetan monk sand.
Oh, well, that's impressive. Liz G also says she was surprised that the rift between Frank and Claire was resolved so quickly and a little disappointed. I like the idea of them being at odds with one another. Are you surprised that they kind of healed this rift pretty quickly? It seems like there's a lot of interesting dramatic possibilities with them being at odds historically.
There is, certainly. Although it seems well within their characters to do so.
Yeah, true.
To heal this rift between them. It's happened before. To see it happen again was not that shocking.
She was thinking that this would be kind of lead to their downfall, but now that they're all healed up, she's concerned with Thomas, the writer, seeming untrustworthy and thinking that his involvement in their lives is going to hurt them both and end somehow. Hmm. I think we're on that same train track of thought too.
You think he could just throw Thomas out of Air Force One? Like, I'm trying to think what's more dramatic. First, you get the car, then you get the subway, now the airplane.
What does the president? Because that's, I've been thinking about the Secret Service a lot and how the fact that they're essentially armed butlers, and anytime heavily armed butlers and trained to kill people with like all manner of weapons, if you believe Tom Clancy, like telescoping batons. Uh-huh. No, I mean, they're just like
pens, magazines.
They're badasses, right?
Born Identity.
And when they roll up with the president and they've got like six SUVs and there's like 20 agents, I'm thinking like, given a determined attacker, and I feel like I've just become part, I'm on some list now.
You are.
Mm-hmm. But given a determined attacker.
Oh, that put you on a list? No, you already were on the list.
Oh, okay. Well, this puts me at the top.
Yep.
How many determined attackers could a team like that repel? Like so, 20 SS, ooh, that sounds right. 20 Secret Service agents versus, I don't know, 50 dudes with submachine guns, like,
50 dudes with machine
guns. Die Hard style, like some kind of Eastern European villain, a Hans Gruber.
Are they, I was going to say, are they in dump trucks? Like,
no.
Are they driving through the sewer system of a city? I don't. 50 with submachine guns, that's a lot of bullets.
But I'm guaranteed those. I'm like, what the hell do those SUVs do? They have like rocket propelled grenade launchers? Do they detach from the ceiling? They clearly got to have some pretty heavy weaponry in them, right?
I don't think those cars
they're not James Bond cars, yeah, no, they're... but they're all bulletproof.
Mm-hmm. I imagine they could take at least 2-1. At least 2-1.
I would think probably more than that.
More?
Because it was shock. Like, if you read Black Hawk Down, it is shocking how much ass 100 Rangers kicked in a whole hostile city.
Yeah, but you didn't have the hostile city armed with submachine guns.
No, they had AK-47s and...
Some of them, not all of them.
And vehicle-mounted heavy machine guns and mortars. And yes, it's impressive. It was impressive.
It was. That was very impressive.
Anyway, what were we talking about?
Is it 747?
No, this was something about the Secret Service. God damn it. Oh, it's going on the next podcast.
I agree.
The next feedback. And this is a truly shocking email. This had me questioning my entire involvement.
Oh my God.
In covering this podcast. Zachary G said, I've never listened to your podcast prior to the season. But I must say that I'm thoroughly enjoying it thus far and think you guys do a great job. That's what blew my mind. What the hell am I doing? And he also appreciates our new release schedule. He goes, but one thing that's bugged me, perhaps because I go to school near Frank's hometown, is that you keep referring to Frank's home state as Georgia. It's not Georgia. It's South Carolina. Gaffney, South Carolina, if we want to get specific. You mentioned it in Chapter 31 episode, and I let it slide, but then you mentioned it again in later episodes. I decided I couldn't bite my tongue any longer. We assumed he was a senator from Georgia just because of the Peachoid, I'm convinced.
So I didn't assume that he was the senator for Georgia.
He's not a senator, he's a representative, first of all.
Yeah, okay.
You
said senator
did
too.
I?
So,
oh,
yeah.
Well, let's nip that mail in the bud.
All right, so I didn't assume he was a representative for Georgia. I thought his hometown was in Georgia. I thought it was in Gaffney was in Georgia.
No, wrong.
And yeah.
You know, the Peachoid, you'd think, because, like, you know, Georgia's peaches. But
and he takes him to his hometown here and shows him the land
the
that his family owns
and
says the peaches wouldn't take. Yeah. And I'm thinking Georgia. Georgia
well, if
peaches.
That farm had been in Georgia, it took it off like a champ.
Oh, yeah.
Like a charm.
Yeah.
So I did a little research, and I found an article about the Peachoid. It says it was commissioned by the Gaffney Board of Public Works, who had a need for elevated water storage and wished to find a way of building it using federal funding.
Okay.
The shape of the peach was selected because the Gaffney economy was then dependent upon peach orchards, and because the people of the town wanted to make it clear that South Carolina, and at one time Cherokee County alone, where Gaffney is located, produced more peaches per year than the entire state of Georgia, which is known as the Peach State. Gaffney, you fucking failed, because
the project was a failure.
That is amazing, and yet I did not know it.
Yep.
I did not know it.
Now we do, though. We will help you in your propaganda project.
Well, what it
South
is
Carolina.
Is you need to get all your big cities to have every fucking street named something along
there
Peach.
You go. Pitt Street.
Peach Street, Peach Avenue, Peach Boulevard, Peach Pit, Peach Tree. God damn, Atlanta. You're scary.
No, you're right. You're right.
That's all the feedback we got.
That's on us, man. We assumed too much there.
We assumed too much.
Okay, cool. Let's end the episode. Tell people where they can contact us.
Houseofcards@baldmove.com. I always say House of Cards.
House of
because
Cards.
Because I'm a redneck hick. But it's houseofcards@baldmove.com. You can get on our forums where I've conveniently created a thread for every episode. And you can keep everything spoiler-free and segmented like that at forums.baldmove.com. Of course, you can get on our Facebook site and comment on facebook.com/baldmove for all of the podcast episodes. And you can holler at Jim or tweet, as they call it, on Twitter, @baldmove.
All right. Sounds good. We'll be back in a couple days with another one of these things. Monday, I think.
Yep.
With another one of these. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.